Welcome to Dominican's Leadership Lecture Series in partnership with Book Passage, Marin and San Francisco's own independent bookstore. My name is Elaine McCarty. I'm director of the Green MBA at Dominican School of Business and Leadership. This lecture series is a program of the Institute of Leadership Studies, a center for leadership development offering education and training for students and professionals to become better, more effective leaders. The Institute also hosts public forums like this one to engage students, our campus, the community, and socially relevant discussions, and to highlight inspired acts of leadership across the disciplines. Our guest this evening, Michael Pollan, has written extensively about the intersection of culture and food, particularly how these two elements have transformed one another. The Green MBA motto exemplifies that important message. Transform yourself, transform business, transform the world. The Green MBA offers a learning community where people with strong environmental and social values develop leadership skills to create and advance economically successful, ecologically restorative, and socially just initiatives in any type of organization. Our lead sponsor for this year's lecture series is Private Ocean, Personal Powerful Wealth Management. Named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide, it is one of the oldest and largest private held wealth management firms in Marin. Joining us this evening to introduce our program is Susan Dixon, partner and chief operating officer of Private Ocean Wealth Management. Dr. Dixon has more than 35 years of experience in business management across several industries, including wealth management, aerospace, wine, food services, and education. She currently serves on the board of 10,000 Degrees, as president of the Junior League of Napa and Sonoma, as member of the Financial Women's Association and the Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council here at Dominican. In addition, she is an adjunct faculty at Dominican School of Business and Leadership. Dr. Dixon recently completed her doctorate at USF after earning both her MBA and her BA here at Dominican School of Business and Leadership. On behalf of the university, we would like to express our deep gratitude to Private Ocean for its generous support of the Leadership Lecture Series and for making these lectures accessible to all of us. Please welcome one of our most cherished alumni, Dr. Susan Dixon.
Well, thank you. That always, I'm like, wow, did I do all that stuff? That's great. Tonight, I am honored to introduce Michael Pollan. After writing about food for so many years, tonight he's turned his attention on how to cook. In his new book, Cooked, Mr. Pollan explores the previously uncharted territory of his own kitchen. Apprenticing himself to a succession of culinary masters, he learns how to grill with fire, cook with liquid, bake bread, and ferment everything from cheese to beer. Mr. Pollan's earlier books have thoroughly scrutinized every other link in the food chain. His work includes 4 New York Times bestsellers: Food Rules, An Eater's Manual, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of 4 Meals, and The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. In 2013, and that was just recently, actually in January, Mr. Pollan was awarded a Premio Nonino Prize in Italy. In 2012, he was given the Distinguished Service Award from the National Association of Biology Teachers. In 2010, Mr. Pollan was named in Time Magazine's annual list of the world's 100 most influential people. He was awarded a Lenin Ono Grant for Peace in 2010. In 2009, he was named by Newsweek as one of the top 10 new thought leaders. A contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine since 1987, His writing has received numerous awards. Among those, he was a finalist for the National Magazine Award in 2009 for Best Essay. He received the James Beard Award for Best Magazine Series in 2003. Mr. Pollan is the John S. and James L. Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and the Director of the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism. Please join me in welcoming Michael Pollan.
How the desire for beer led to the birth of agriculture, why we should use more salt in the kitchen, not less. That's popular. Why the family meal is the nursery of democracy, why the next front in the food movement is your kitchen, if gluten is the problem, and there's always a question about gluten, right? But if gluten is the problem, fermentation may be the solution. The erotics of disgust, or why some people like a stinky cheese. That's an interesting one. Be sure to ask me about that. So this book was not in my life plan to write a book on cooking. In fact, I was once asked after I published Omnivore's Dilemma, would you do a cookbook or write a book on cooking? And I was like, absolutely not. But the more I started working on the food chain, and that's really been my project now for 12 years, I think, which is to say, learning about this food system in which we all are implicated in various ways and affected in many ways. So I started out in Omnivore's Dilemma to write about the earth end of the food chain, agriculture, where the food comes from. And then I kind of jumped ahead all the way to the other extreme end and looked at the body end of the food chain, which is to say what happens in our bodies when we ingest various foods and what are the links, what do we know about diet and health. But I had kind of overlooked this middle link, which is the one where the stuff coming off the farms gets transformed into delicious and nutritious, or the opposite, meals through a process of cooking when it's done by human beings, and food processing, which is the word we use when corporations do it. And I came to see that that process had a dramatic influence both at the beginning of the food chain and on the health question. So, for example, it really was the industrialization of cookery by the fast food industry and the processed food industry that drove a lot of the changes I was writing about in agriculture. So that, you know, when McDonald's and Burger King and KFC needed vast amounts of beef or potatoes or whatever it was, they drove the homogenization of our agriculture, you know, only one kind of potato, giant monocultures, which require lots of pesticide, and also big feedlots to produce huge amounts of chicken and beef and pork. And so that the way we eat and the way we prepare our food has a dramatic effect on the way we farm. And you can't get away, if you want to change the way we farm, you've really got to look at this question of how we're eating and how we're processing food. So that was one side. And then on the other side, on the health side, the more for in defense of food and food rules, I really look closely at what do we know and what don't we know about nutrition science. And I discovered that this whole conversation we have as a society about nutrients, good or bad, really doesn't explain very much. And in fact, the most important things about your diet is who's preparing it. Is it a corporation who's cooking your food, or is it a human being? And that is a bigger predictor of health than anything you might decide about, I'm gonna eat this nutrient, I'm not gonna have this nutrient, or this is how many calories I'm gonna have. That the best predictor of a healthy diet is a human being in charge of cooking it. So I realized that there was this whole middle link of the food chain that I needed to take account of because it was really important, even though it struck me as the most obvious one. It's the one we have the most daily traffic with, the one we think we know about. Although I discovered there's a lot we don't know about cooking. There's a lot we take for granted that's actually pretty interesting once you delve down and try to figure out what makes this, what constitutes these amazing transformations of nature into culture. I also had a bit of an epiphany when I was working on a piece for the New York Times that they had assigned me to do in 2009 when that movie Julie and Julia came out about Julia Child. And they asked me to do a piece on TV cooking shows and why are we so fascinated by them. And I started watching primetime cooking shows, a lot of them, and was kind of struck by this interesting paradox, which was that while home cooking was kind of declining in America, and we were only putting in about 27 minutes a day per person preparing food now, which is half as much time as we spent in the 1960s, the watching of cooking on television was exploding. And why is it that people are willing to spend more time watching other people cook on TV than cooking themselves? And I don't need to point out, I don't think, that you don't get to eat the food that you see being cooked on television. So I call this the cooking paradox, and I spent some time trying to unpack it and figure out why would that be. And I came up with a couple ideas about it. One is that, you know, there's many things in modern life we have outsourced to corporations, and we haven't looked back. Changing the oil in your car or repairing your car, you know, who watches TV shows about that? Or sewing clothes or darning socks. I mean, there's plenty of stuff we just like, great, it's taken care of now. We don't do it ourselves, for better or worse. But cooking is different. Cooking, we're looking back. We're obsessing about it, in fact, in this culture. We go to restaurants with open kitchens so we can watch it happen. We have chefs or celebrities in our culture right now, such as never has been the case before. I think it has something to do with the fact that most of us have powerful memories of being in the kitchen with a loved one who was cooking for us, something delicious, something really special to us, and watching those alchemies unfold, those amazing transformations that happen. I mean, I have very vivid memories of my mother making my favorite dish, which she would make for my birthday. It was chicken Kiev. It's a real 60s dish that, you know, is on kind of hard times and I think deserves a comeback. Now, the low-fat craze probably killed off chicken Kiev, but basically what it is she would hammer flat, and I would help. I would, like, bang on the chicken breast, this very, you know, very flat breast of chicken. And then she'd roll it in the center, take, like, a quarter stick of butter, and a lot, that's what got into trouble, and a lot of, and herbs, and some pepper and stuff, and she'd roll it and create this kind of tight package. Then she'd dip that in egg, and then dip that in breadcrumbs, and then she'd fry, deep fat fry the whole thing. I would defend it on nutritional grounds too, if I must, but on aesthetic grounds, it doesn't need to be defended. So you ended up with this beautiful golden torpedo, and everybody got their own one, and when you cut into it with a knife, there was this gust of herbs that would, you know, come at you, and then this pool of butter, and I recommend it. It's really, really good. So I don't offer a recipe for it in the book, but if you wrote me, I'd be happy to give you one. Actually, I've given you the recipe. You know all you need to know. So a lot of us have memories, and they're very powerful, warm memories of that process. And I think that's something that recalls us to cooking. But it may be that there are even deeper roots to this. You know, I'm not a Jungian, and I don't know if I believe in racial memories, but there is a way in which the past persists in unexpected ways that we're not aware of. And as I learned about the history of cooking, I learned that this goes very deep in our history and probably was decisive in our evolution. And I learned about, when I was doing research for the book, about something called the cooking hypothesis, which is a concept put forward by a Harvard primatologist and anthropologist named Richard Wrangham, who's a character in the book. And he's trying to solve a mystery that many people in anthropology have been trying to solve for a long time, which is why all of a sudden did we diverge from the apes and develop these very large, complex brains, and at the same moment, our gut, our digestive apparatus, shrank. Something happened to change the course of our evolution in a key way, because when this happens is when we really begin to acquire skills like language and civilization really begins. And some people have said it's about meat eating because we had this new source of concentrated calories. Although he kind of proves that meat eating alone doesn't explain it, because if you're eating meat that isn't cooked, you spend a lot of energy digesting it. It's very hard to break it down. So he proposes that the key development was the discovery and control of fire. And that when we did this, which he estimates at 2 million years ago, that's before we were Homo sapiens, we were still Homo erectus, and that's when this explosion happens. When we learned how to cook food, we got this incredible boon in calories. And that enough to underwrite the growth of the human brain, and for reasons I'll explain, the shrinkage of the human gut. Although we say the human gut is going the opposite direction right now, but for 2 million years, it was on a different path. And that is, when you cook food, your body, it's much easier to digest. Digestion takes up about 10% of our energy needs, consumes about 10%. But in animals, it's a lot higher, because you're eating all this raw plant material or raw animal material, and it takes a lot of energy to break it down. So when you cook it, you save that energy. You also detoxify many foods. There are many foods that you can't eat unless they're cooked, like potatoes and cassava and other tubers. And so we have access to those calories that no other animal has or no other mammal has. And when you cook food, it doesn't need to be chewed as much. And in fact, if you look at apes our size, they spend half of their waking hours, about 6 hours a day, in the mere act of chewing. It's no wonder they don't get a lot done. And chimps like to hunt, and they know how to hunt, and they like to eat meat, but they only have about 18 minutes a day to do it, and that's not enough, because they're chewing all the time. So it's that time that we no longer have to chew, and that energy we no longer have to use to digest frees us up and leads to this expansion in the size of the human brain, reduction in the size of the human gut, and this other incredible thing happens when you cook, which is you have meals. The hunter-gatherer doesn't really need to have organized meals, but the cook does, because you have a fire, and the fire needs to be tended, so you need cooperation. Somebody has to take care of the fire while someone else is hunting or getting the food. And once you have the cooked meal, a very subtle thing changes, which is you have this bunch of animals gathered around this very promising loin of whatever, and they have to delay gratification until it cooks. And they also have to share it. They can't simply have the biggest, toughest animal grabbing it all. So suddenly you need rules. Suddenly you need rules about sharing and taking turns. And suddenly you need the beginnings of a society, of a civilization. So cooking gives us the meal, and the meal gives us civilization. So all of which is just to say cooking goes really deep, and cooking is closely tied to meals. And neither of those two things, to leap ahead to 2 million years, are happening quite the way they were. We're cooking less, and we're having meals less often. The USDA tracks something called secondary eating. I'd never heard this term. It's eating while you're doing other things. It's eating in the car. It's eating while you're working. It's eating, while you're watching television or surfing the internet. I was in New York about a month ago, and I saw a woman in Central Park eating and running at the same time. This is a new frontier in secondary eating, where you strive to balance out your caloric intake and outtake. Exactly. And secondary eating is... Now, we spend more time in secondary eating than we do in what the USDA calls calls primary eating, an activity you know probably as meals. We spend 78 minutes on secondary eating and 67 minutes on primary eating. So as we cook less, we eat together less. And that's, I think, a real tragedy, because meals, as they were back then, 2 million years ago, still are a very important civilizing agent. Meals are where our children learn to share, to take turns, to argue without offending. They learn the art of adult conversation. Amazing things happen at the family dinner table. And that's why I say, as I did in those talking points, that the family meal is the nursery of democracy, because all those skills I just described are what you need to have a functioning democracy. So that's a great loss. So what do we have instead? Well, I wanted to give you a little taste of the book, read a passage about a very unusual meal that my family had in the course of writing this book. We were doing a lot of home cooking, and as you heard, you know, I was apprenticing myself to various chefs and masters of various kinds, and we were lots of experiments, and my wife and my son got involved. At some point, as often happens if you cook so many meals in a row at home, you kind of want a break. And my son came up with this idea to break the cycle of home cooking. And he said, hey, I got an idea. What if we went down to the Safeway and we all got to buy one of those microwavable entrees, which he had never tried, but he was kind of curious about. And I'm thinking, I hate to waste a meal, you know. But I said, well, this could be good for the book. Which is how a fair portion of my life is organized. And so we decided to do it, and we called it Microwave Night. And I'm going to read you the account of what happened. And I thought it would be an interesting experiment because I was curious to know how convenient is convenient food, how much does it cost, and how does it taste? And so this was our effort to answer that. And this happens in the chapter called Water, which is all about home cooking. Pot cooking. So the next afternoon after school, we drove to the Safeway, grabbed a shopping cart, and wheeled it down the long, chilly aisle of freezer cases holding the microwavable dinners. The choices were stupendous, almost stupefying, in fact. It took us more than 20 minutes just to decide among the bags of frozen Chinese stir fry, the boxed Indian biryanis and curries, the fish and chip dinners, the multi-flavored mac and cheese options, the Japanese gyoza and Indonesian satays, the Thai rice bowls, the old-timey Salisbury steaks, the roast turkey and fried chicken dinners, the beef stroganoff, the burritos and tacos and fully loaded hero sandwiches, the frozen garlic bread and sliders, and the cheeseburgers pre-installed on their frozen buns. There were whole product lines targeted at women trying to minimize their caloric intake and others at men looking to maximize theirs. The Hungry Man TV dinner promised a full pound of great tasting food. And still others aimed at kids dreaming of an authentic fast food restaurant experience at home. I hadn't spent much time on this aisle in years, so had no idea just how many advances there had been in the technology of what the industry calls, appropriately, home meal replacement. That's what they're selling, home meal replacement. Every genre of fast food, every ethnic cuisine, every chain restaurant menu item known to man and commerce now has its facsimile in the freezer case. Judith, my wife, was willing to go along with our dinner plans, but declined to join us shopping for it. She had requested a frozen lasagna, and Isaac spotted a bright red box of Stouffer's that looked halfway appetizing. Dubious about eating meat under the circumstances, I first checked out a vegan chicken cacciatore entree, but the lengthy list of ingredients, most of them ultra-processed permutations of soy, put me off the mock meat. So I opted for an organic vegetable curry from Amy's that seemed fairly straightforward in composition. At least, I recognized all the ingredients as food, which is saying a lot in this sector of the supermarket. Isaac, my son, agonized a good long time. But his problem was the opposite of mine. There were just too many tempting entrees he wanted to try. Eventually, it came down to a call between the bag of P.F. Chang's Shanghai-style beef stir-fry and Safeway's own French onion soup gratiné. This was an amazing thing. It was this frozen rocket with three stages, you know, brown stage for soup, then a kind of toasted colored stage for bread, I guess, and then a white stage on top for melted cheese. It kind of looked like a Don King fright wig. I told him he could get them both, as well as some frozen molten chocolate cookie he'd been eyeing for dessert. The total for the three of us came to $27, more than I would have expected. Some of the entrees, like Isaac's stir-fry, promised to feed more than one person, but this seemed doubtful given the portion size. Later that week, I went to the farmer's market and found that with $27, I could easily buy a couple of pounds of an inexpensive cut of grass-fed beef and enough vegetables to make a braise that would feed the three of us for at least one night and probably two. The variable, as ever, is Isaac's appetite. So there was a price to pay for letting the team of P.F. Chang, Stouffer's Safeway, and Amy's cook our dinner. So how did it all taste? Well, a lot like airline food, if you can remember what that was like. It's not a reference that will survive much longer, I'm afraid. All the entrees tasted remarkably similar, considering how far-flung their culinary inspirations. They were all salty and had that generic fast food flavor, a sort of bouillon-y taste that probably can be traced to the hydrolyzed vegetable protein that several of the dishes contain. This is an ingredient label euphemism for monosodium glutamate, or MSG, basically a cheap way to boost the perception of umami, which is the Japanese word for savoriness, the fifth taste, which is something that fast food really amps up to cover up the fact that it has no real flavor. The dishes all tasted better on the first bite, when you might be tempted to think, hey, not half bad, then on the second or third bite, when those words would be unlikely to cross your mind. There is a short half-life to the taste of a frozen dinner, which I would peg somewhere around bite number three, after which the whole experience rapidly deteriorates. Oh, but wait, I've skipped over the cooking or not cooking segment of our meal, which you probably assumed, as I certainly did, would be nominal, and so not worth going into in this account. That is, after all, the reason people buy these frozen dinners in the first place, isn't it? Well, if it is, they're sorely mistaken, because it took nearly an hour to get all our entrees on the table and hot. For one thing, you could only microwave one of them at a time, and we had four to defrost and heat, not counting the molten frozen cookie. Also, one of the packages warned that we would not get optimal results in the microwave. The various stages that made up the frozen round rocket of onion soup, would meld together pointlessly in the microwave. If we wanted the gratiné effect promised on the package, then we had to bake it in the oven at 350 degrees for 40 minutes. I could make onion soup from scratch in 40 minutes. Isaac didn't want to wait that long, so we ended up taking turns standing in front of the microwave. Is there any more futile, soul-irradiating experience than standing before the little window on a microwave oven, watching the carousel slowly revolve your frozen block of dinner? Time spent this way might be easier than cooking, but it is not enjoyable and surely not ennobling. It is to feel spiritually unemployed, useless to self and humanity. I know, I'm a little hard on the microwave. Let me just quickly acknowledge what it's good for. Reheating coffee, defrosting leftovers and frozen vegetables, and I think I'll leave it there. Anyway, as soon as the first dish was hot, we swapped it out for the second, but by the time the fourth entree was hot enough to eat, the first one had gotten cold and needed renuking. Isaac finally asked permission to start eating his onion soup before it got cold. The advent of the microwave has not been a boon to table manners. He was already down to the bottom of his bowl when Judas lasagna emerged from the oven. The problem with the microwave, when you compare it with the casserole, say, or the cook fire, is that it's not a communal technology. It's an individualistic technology. I describe it as the Ayn Rand of appliances. It's kind of like every man for himself, you know? Microwave night turned out to be one of the most disjointed family dinners we have had since Isaac was a toddler. The three of us never quite got to sit down at the table all at once. The best we could manage was to overlap for several minutes at a time, since one or another of us was constantly having to get up to check the microwave or the stovetop, where Isaac had moved to stir-fry after the microwave got backed up. All told, the meal took a total of 37 minutes to defrost and heat up the first time, not counting reheating, easily enough time to make a respectable family dinner. It made me think Harry Balzer might be right. He's a character in the book, a kind of very cynical food marketing consultant from Chicago who works for the food industry. He might be right to attribute the triumph of this kind of eating to laziness and a lack of skills or confidence, or a desire to eat a great many different kinds of food, which I think is probably the most accurate, rather than to a genuine lack of time. That we hadn't saved much of at all. So thank you. That's a very, not a typical meal that you will read about in the book. So how did we get here? Is a question I try to answer. What happened to cooking? And the history is an interesting one, and it's a little different than the version that you may have heard. I spent a lot of time looking at this, and it seems to me it was very much of a supply-driven phenomenon, not a demand-driven phenomenon, and that the food industry had been trying to worm its way into our kitchens and our families for a very long time, for about 100 years. I mean, you know, Betty Crocker, in a way, was one of the first efforts to bring processed food into the house. She basically domesticated processed food. She redefined cooking as take the can of Campbell's mushroom soup and add to this, and that was the first wave. But the second wave doesn't come till after World War II. And that, during the war, the industry had invented some really cool things, like powdered coffee, instant coffee, dehydrated foods, simulated foods of all kinds, shelf-stable foods that you could put in a bag and keep on a shelf for years. Basically, field rations that were clever, and they wanted to use this technology and sell it to us after the war. But the initial response on the part of women who were doing most of the cooking in America was very negative. They didn't want to do this. When the first cake mixes were invented in the 50s, they were just add water cake mixes that Duncan Hines and Pillsbury introduced, and they bombed. And they did some focus groups, and they found that, well, women didn't like them because they couldn't own a cake that they had only, you know, added water to and put in the oven, and they didn't feel they could take credit for it, no matter how good it might be. And so they came up with this very clever solution. And I tell you this just to show you how intent they were on breaking down this resistance. And that was to take out the powdered egg that was in that mix and let women do the work of cracking an egg so they could feel like they were contributing. And then that resistance considerably broke down. But their real breakthrough comes in the 60s and 70s, when you have the feminist revolution, second wave feminism, and you have women entering the workforce in big numbers. When this happens, there is a clear need, and it was articulated by people like Betty Friedan, to renegotiate the division of labor in the American home. It simply wasn't fair if women were going to be working for them also to be doing the cleaning and the ironing and the child care and the cooking. So this very uncomfortable conversation began in across kitchen tables all across America over how this work was going to be redivided in the interest of fairness. It was a really uncomfortable, intense conversation, and the industry recognized it had an opportunity here. What they could do was offer to solve this problem, relieve this tension, and they did. And they exploited feminist rhetoric to do it. And the signal event, in my view, this is part of a much larger marketing campaign, was Kentucky Fried Chicken took out billboards across America with a giant bucket of fried chicken, you know, the six-person family size, with just two words overhead: women's liberation. They redefined not cooking as a very progressive thing to do. And it solved a problem that everybody wanted solved. And so a lot of the resistance to letting corporations cook for us melted away. So I think that's really what did it. And this message can be simplified into people saying, So feminism killed home cooking, and that's not right at all. I don't think that that's what I'm saying at all. So I think that's how we got here. Now, my book is only partly an argument about that, as I suggested. What I was interested in doing, having recognized that food, that cooking food was really important, was try to do what I do in all my books, whether I'm writing about gardens or plants or agriculture or health, is to drill down all the way to the bottom and find the essential meaning of this activity. Where does it come from? How did it change us as a species, as we already discussed, but also as communities, as families, as individuals? And I did this by trying to figure out, all right, let me see if I can break cooking down into its key constituents. And it seemed to me there were four basic transformations that almost all cooking could be divided into. And that this was cooking with fire, cooking with water, cooking with air, and cooking with earth, which is my shorthand for fermentation. It so happened that actually it was my wife who came up with the structure. And I had known that, I knew that there were these different transformations, and the fire was first one, water was the second. She says, well, it sounds like the classical elements. And then I looked a little further, and yeah, it did kind of fit. Now, you can probably think of examples of cooking that don't fit. Like, I don't know where to put sushi. You could say it's raw, but in fact, it's sort of cooked. It's gone through this process of being cultured. So the book is arranged in terms of those four transformations, and in each case, I apprentice myself to a master or several and learn how to do it and get to the essence of cooking with fire, which took me to North Carolina and barbecue. I went to Eastern North Carolina and studied whole hog barbecue. And then water was home cooking, and we can talk about these individual transformations a little more often. But I want to leap ahead to the third one was baking, and I learned how to bake with Chad Robertson, a wonderful baker in San Francisco at Tartine. But the last one, the last set of transformations, in a way, turned out to be the most fascinating to me, and these are the ones that I've continued to stay very involved with, although I still do a lot of baking and home cooking too. And that was fermentation. What an amazing thing that you can transform food without any heat whatsoever, strictly by the use of microbes, bacteria, and fungi. And you can make alcohol that way, and you can make sauerkraut and kimchi, and you can take perishable milk and make long-lived cheese that has such a more interesting flavor. And so I got really deep into microbiology, and some of you may have seen the piece in the Times yesterday where it's kind of the next phase of that work, although I do talk about it in the book as well, which is to say the fermentations that go on within our body also. We too are vessels of fermentation. There is cooking that happens here and in our large intestine. And I worked with a cheesemaker there named Sister Nuella, this most amazing character. She's a cheesemaker and she's a microbiologist, and learned a lot about bacteria and kind of got over my fear of bacteria. I hung out with these fermentos, these passionate lovers of bacteria, and there are many of them in this community, you know, who are great picklers and cheesemakers, and they are trying to... they're really pacifists in the war in bacteria that the rest of us have been recruited into being foot soldiers for. And so renegotiating our relationship with the microbes becomes a very pressing matter right now, because I think we've gone way overboard in our war against bacteria. So food takes you to the most amazing places. And so I ended up there with beer, actually. That miracle, I mean, think of it, that Saccharomyces cerevisiae, this little fungus that you can't even see, gives us not only bread, but gives us alcohol, a molecule with the power to change what goes on in our minds. You know, we talk about the dog as man's best friend. I don't think so. Anyway, I'm going to leave it right there and take some of your questions. Thank you.
Yes. So much. That was fantastic. I have one question from someone who actually must have read the book, because she asked about secondary eating, and she says, I noticed that when I'm in certain countries, people don't do that, and they seem to live longer. Do you is there any scientific evidence for this?
No. not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think the problem with secondary eating is that, think about the foods you tend to eat that way. They have to be convenience foods. All right, there are baby carrots, okay? So that's the best food you can secondarily eat, probably. But in general, it's snack foods. It's chips. It's basically permutations of corn and soy. There's not a lot of healthy food eaten that way. It tends to be, if you look at the obesity statistics from 1980, when we're eating between 400 and 500 more calories per person per day, I mean, there's your obesity epidemic, most of those calories are in the form of refined carbohydrates and soy oil, and it's corn and soy-based snack foods, and that's really where it's coming from. So in general, if you're eating meals, the odds are you're eating healthier food. You know, there is the Paula Deen exception. But there's always an exception that proves the rule.
Thank you for mentioning that one. I have several questions here about gluten intolerance. But one of them that interested me a lot was the person who said that her mother is gluten intolerant. But when she goes to Paris, she can have bread and brioche or whatever. What is going on there?
That's an urban legend, actually. I hear that everywhere I go, that I can eat bread in Europe, but I can't eat it here. I don't know if you're aware, but most of the flour used to bake bread in Europe comes from Canada and North Dakota. So it's not quite as French as you might think. You know, the only reason that might be true is if you were eating bread in Europe that had received a very kind of slow sourdough fermentation. And there are breads that are still made that way. But your average baguette is no longer made that way. I think that there are people who struggle with gluten, and there are people with celiac disease, which is a very serious disorder that affects 1% or 2% of the population. But there are also a lot of people who the power of suggestion has convinced them that this nutrient explains why they're feeling bad. Mm. And the removal of this nutrient from their diet makes them feel better. I don't want to trivialize what many people are really experiencing, but the growth in the number of people who claim to have gluten intolerance, it's so fast. I mean, you look at how fast the product category has grown in just the last 5 years that it's hard to believe it's strictly a biological phenomenon. That said, there are a couple of explanations that might explain why more people are having trouble with gluten, and I explore them in the book. One is our immune systems are screwed up in all sorts of ways, that partially having probably to do with our relationship to bacteria and what's going on in the gut, the westernized microbiome. And so that we are, our bodies, I mean, we've had an increase in all kinds of autoimmune disease, in asthma and eczema, and this is a sign that our immune system are failing to make accurate distinctions between friend and foe, and why they might turn on a protein like, you know, that's been a mainstay of human civilization for, you know, 6,000 years, gluten. That's one explanation. The other is that the way we make bread today is very different than the way it used to be made. We don't have these long sourdough fermentations, and there is some interesting research that suggests that when you cook that way, when you bake that way, you break down the gluten and make it much more digestible. We're using instant yeast, leavening bread as fast as we can, and that may be leaving the gluten in a form that is more noxious. So I'm offering basically four theories, and I don't know what's the answer, and it may not be one. It may be some combination of the four, but we don't really know the answer. But this thing of going to Europe and it's fine, okay. Enjoy your baguette.
Why not? This person wants to talk about the traditional diet that you recommend in Omnivore's Dilemma, and as a side question, wants to know what you had to eat today.
What did I have to eat today? You know, I think I kind of eat the way you'd expect that I would eat. I ate today, I had whole grain toast, bread I'd gotten at the farmer's market with some preserves. And for lunch, I did have takeout sushi. And for dinner, we're going to have leftovers. And we eat a lot of leftovers. We tried to cook extra of whatever we're making. And last night, we made this, my wife made this beautiful farro salad with spring vegetables and mushrooms, you know, asparagus and peas and mint. And she made a vast quantity of it. So we get to eat that tonight.
We'll try to get you out of here, see. You mentioned more salt in the kitchen. Could you talk a little bit more about that? That sounded great, but what does that mean?
Well, a couple things. And one of the things I learned, I mean, there are various kind of secrets or tips I learned along the way in this book. And one of them was really curious, that all the professional chefs I talked to said, use a lot more salt than you're using. One of them went so far as to say, use 5 times as much salt as you think when you're salting meat. 5 times? And I did a little digging and learned that first, most of the salt in the American diet comes from processed food, 80% of it, okay? So if you're not eating processed food, you probably don't have to worry about salt. And indeed, there's some question of whether we should worry about it under any circumstances. I think we probably should, but not as much as we do. So if you leave aside processed food where most of the salt is, it leaves you a lot of freedom. And what happens when you salt, and I'm talking about meat here specifically, when you're salting meat, we tend to do it the same day we're cooking it and pretty lightly, and you don't get a lot of flavor. But restaurant chefs who know what they're doing, actually some will say the key to good cooking is salting, which they call seasoning. It's kind of a euphemism for salting. And the reason is, if you salt 24 hours or even 36 hours in advance, 48 hours, I mean a long time in advance, and then just put the meat, chicken, whatever it is, in the fridge, uncovered, the salt initially draws the moisture out of the cells. And then something interesting happens. A vacuum is created in those cells, and the wet salty liquid on the surface, which may also have your pepper or whatever other seasonings you perhaps put on it, is drawn back into the cells so that the salt really penetrates along with the spices and whatever other flavorings you put on. But it needs time for this to happen. And if you just are going to salt like 2 hours before you're cooking, all you're going to do is dry it out. You're going to get step one and not step two. So try it. And I've been like trying to salt 2 days in advance. I know it involves a little bit more planning. And you'll be amazed at the results. And the food doesn't taste salty. It just tastes really vivid. So anyway, that's the tip I learned about salt.
My doctor's in the audience. I'm going to have to talk to her later. Not too long ago, Mark Bittman suggested a Peace Corps type organization for teaching people to cook and sending people throughout the country. Having come from Indiana, I can see a place for that. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's a terrific idea. I mean, I think we have a generation that didn't learn to cook from their parents, is not learning to cook at school. Home ec is, you know, barely exists in some places. And the loss of these skills is a tremendous loss in a cultural sense and in a public health sense. So how are we going to teach people? And there is something called Food Corps already, which is a small program that is incredibly popular and is oversubscribed. They get thousands of applicants for dozens of positions. And they go off and help build school gardens and work on school programs. And I think they should expand their focus to cooking. You know, we talk a lot about food security and food access these days and the concept of food deserts, which Michelle Obama's been talking about a lot. But I've talked to people who work in that area, who succeed in bringing healthy food into the inner city. I was talking to someone who has a mobile produce stand in Chicago and goes into underserved areas with this beautiful bus that's been outfitted with shelves of, you know, lovely produce on both sides, really low prices. And you know what? It doesn't do the trick. He finds enormous resistance. And what he discovers is that many people in the inner city don't know what to do with the fresh produce. And they're afraid it's going to rot in their refrigerator, and it probably will. So in a way, he's got to follow that bus with another bus that has a mobile kitchen and offers people cooking lessons. Getting supermarkets into the inner city doesn't solve all your problems. There's lots of crap in the supermarket, as we know. But access, food security is not just about access. It's also about skills. And so I totally agree with Mark Bittman that teaching those skills is a very high priority.
And one last question, which would be, if you could do anything for the next generation, what would it be, and what would you teach them?
Well, a couple things. One would be cooking skills. I mean, I think where we are on food in this country right now is that we've had this great forgetting, beginning in the 50s or 60s, as we moved into this processed and fast food world. We were encouraged to think of food as just this thing, this commodity, this fuel, and maybe this slightly entertaining thing. The full power of what it can do for people, what it is, what it connects us to, was kind of lost. And food became this image of, the Big Mac, the Happy Meal, the KFC bucket, whatever it is. And food was kind of detached from the net of relationships that it really has historically been. Which is to say, food connects us to other people. It's a very profound social medium. Food connects us to nature. It's our most profound engagement with other species, is eating them. And food, it's true. Sorry. food is not a thing. It's a set of relationships. And we are being recalled to that right now. We are being reminded of that. Our chefs are doing it. Writers are doing it. And it's a very exciting time to begin to reconnect with food that way. I think cooking is the most profound way to make that reconnection. And there are excesses, as there is in any revolution. There is the Portlandia phenomenon of people obsessing about the happiness of the chicken on its last day on this earth. It's very easy to make fun of the excesses of foodie culture. But I think that's kind of harmless. In the larger context of what we're being recalled to. I look forward to a day where we won't have to obsess about the chicken's last day or where it came from, because as a matter of course, we'll just know, because they're not producing chickens that bad way anymore. And we can talk about other things at dinner and not be obsessed. But we're not there yet. Thank you very much.